This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the recent Health and Living Live 2018 event by AIA Vitality.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, time for our second session for this morning. Our speakers for this session two on quality end-of-life cancer care. Please welcome the President of the National Cancer Society of Malaysia, Dr. Santari Somasundaram. Dr. Martin Melo Abdullah, the Consultant Clinical Oncologist, Subangjaya Medical Center. And Dr. Sylvia McCarthy, Medical Director, Hospice Malaysia. And our moderator of session two, the host and presenter of Health and Living, and a lady who's interviewed so many doctors and people in the medical profession that she could easily pass a medical exam herself. Please welcome Meera Sivasodhi.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to see you here. I know when you saw that end-of-life care, palliative care on the screen, it's probably means doom and gloom for most of us because nobody really wants to talk about it. So we decided that we'll do that today. First of all, let me just quickly give you a quick report card about cancer here in Malaysia, and then I'll get to the good news after that. First of all, unfortunately, one in four of us will suffer cancer by the age of 75. Some of the most common cancers in Malaysia, amongst women, number one cancer is breast cancer, followed by colorectal cancer, followed by cervical cancer. Amongst men, the most common cancers are colorectal cancer at number one, lung cancer number two, and nasopharyngeal cancer in number three, third place. 51% of cancer patients will be pushed into financial hardship. And that's something that needs to be addressed very, very seriously in this country. We have a shortage of oncologists in the public sector. Am I correct, Dr. Martin? We only have 110 oncologists in the country, 30% of whom are in the public sector, 70% in the private sector. Guilty, Dr. Martin. Good news is cancer can be prevented. 30 to 50% of cancers can be prevented. It can be detected early, and it can be treated well. And that's the good news, really, about cancer. And we're going to have this discussion with our three experts here today, and we'll also talk about palliative care. Please ask your questions. I'm happy to take them as we go along. First of all, I'm going to start with Dr. Soundri. You've spent 20 years in the National Cancer Society of Malaysia. How have you seen, how has our understanding of cancer changed over the 20 years?
Yes, 20 years seems a long time, and it is in that sense that 20 years ago, many of the people here in this hall wouldn't be here. If you're a cancer survivor, can you put up your hand, please? Exactly. 20 years ago, cancer survivors wouldn't identify themselves because there was a huge stigma with cancer. There was a huge worry that if people knew that you had cancer, you wouldn't be able to work. Your community would ostracize you. Your family would ostracize you. And in that 20 years, we've made leaps and bounds in that aspect of cancer. And that's come about with a lot of things. One is the empowerment of people with cancer, but it's also because cancer no longer needs to be that death sentence that we all remember. And that's because there's advances in terms of the prevention and early detection of cancer, but primarily because of treatment of cancer.
Just very quickly, how many of you here think cancer equals death? Be honest. In the beginning, yeah. Cancer equals death. Okay.
Can I ask one question then? How many of you think that heart disease equals death? You see, at least there's more people now saying heart disease compared to cancer.
Yeah, that's a development, isn't it? Dr. Martin, we have one of the problems in Malaysia when it comes to cancer is patients are presenting late in the third and fourth stage of cancer. Now, that is a big problem. I'm sure you see the brunt of it. Based on patient feedback, why are they presenting lead?
I've worked in both sides of the divide. I've been in the public sector for 16
Quickly,
years.
You are defending yourself now.
Yeah, 16 years in the public sector and 17 years now in the private sector. So I see both sides of the divide. Now, in the public sector, certainly, the fact that we see a lot of patients presenting late is very common. And that percentage can be as high as 30 to 40%. And the main reason for that is the fact that there are alternative therapies that are being pushed to them. And the health sector itself is not absolved for blame, because there are issues with regard to diagnosis, the time taken for them to be seen, to be investigated, for the pathology report to be coming back. So that takes some time as well. So that some of the factors that contributes to the late stage representation. Now, in the private sector, it's a bit more different because we're looking at a different demography. Those are people who are very much more educated and aware of things. And in the private sector that I've seen the last 16 years, the number of patients present late is much lesser.
Why is it it's different in the private sector?
Well, the difference is because we're dealing with people who are very motivated, people who are well-educated, they look after themselves. But having said that, like I said, it's not not all will present in an early stage. And in fact, education may have a role to play, but having said that, again, I've come across very well-educated doctors even, doctor in private practice even, presenting with late breast cancer, with fungating tumour in the breast. That's when they present. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is. They are well educated, yet they present late. But the percentages are much lesser in the private sector.
Dr. Soundary, you deal with a lot of patients. Why are they presenting late?
I think, as Martin mentioned, you know, there is a complexity to the whole thing. When you look at it in terms of community, there's still stigmas in the community in terms of cancer. There's fear associated with cancer. But when you look at the systems, I think our systems are failing us to a certain extent in the earlier detection of cancer. So there needs to be a greater focus in the primary healthcare, in the recognition of the signs and symptoms of cancer. And then from that point onwards, it's the system which allows them to get into the tertiary, so the hospitals, much faster. And that's difficult because sometimes the hospitals aren't close to home. And so you have transport issues. You have issues in terms of trying to get off work to be able to go into the hospitals. And once you get into the hospital systems, there are also long delays in terms of the investigations, from the point of investigation to the point of results, etc. So there's a lot of, there's a huge complexity in terms of the factors which lead to the point of treatment at late stage. So you could also actually be diagnosed fairly early. By the time you get to treatment, again, because of the system, but because of fear and because, as Malaysians, we tend to also look at alternative treatments, at the point of treatment, it becomes late.
Dr. Sylvia, if a lot of Malaysians are presenting late, there is possibly a need for palliative care. At Hospice Malaysia, I mean, do you see people coming in and consulting you regarding palliative care? Because, I mean, I do admit as a society, we really don't want to even talk about death. But is palliative care, does that equal death? Is that what we're preparing for? And that's really the perception, really.
I think it is a good sign that I'm sitting here along with talking about prevention and treatment, because I think the perception of palliative care may be about death, but I hope to be able to change that perception a bit, because it's very much about helping people to live better with their illness. And there is now some very good data that shows that having palliative care at the same time as having treatment for your stage 3, stage 4 disease results in better outcomes, primarily in terms of quality of life, but also actually in prolonging life. So I would say no, it's all about helping people to live better. And I would encourage people to seek palliative care at the same time as speaking to your oncologist to help get through that treatment and get through also the emotional aspects and the distress around having a cancer diagnosis and the impact that has on everybody's lives, your own, your family, your carers around you. And palliative care is there as a support.
Dr. Sylvia just said three things which, does it resonate with you? Palliative care equals help you live better. You're at end stage here. It leads to better outcomes and it prolongs your life. Does that make sense to you? It does? Could you elaborate a little? Because the perception is, I'm ready to stop living. Is that correct?
Not at all. I think, you know, when you're diagnosed with an illness, a life-limiting illness, and you know that time is now limited, what you want to do is live as well as you can and make the best out of the treatments that are available. And there's some very complex decision-making. I think there was your introductory video had a lovely piece about that. How do you decide what's the best to do? Those are complex decisions, and palliative care can help with that. If you're feeling better, if you've got less pain, less breathlessness, if your nausea vomiting is controlled, you're in a much better place, and you're a much better place to live.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion from the recent Health and Living Live 2018 event by AIA Vitality. This is an edited recording of the recent Health and Living Live 2018 event by AIA Vitality.
Dr. Martin, you guys want a chemo away. When does this conversation about palliative care start with you, the oncologist?
The discussion about palliative care should go together with the planned treatment, the active anti-cancer treatment. So it should go together, really, hand in hand. But there's always this perception that palliative care equals end-of-life care. So the point at which you introduce the discussion about palliative care can be very, very sensitive, not so much to us, but to patients, because their perception might change. And essentially, when we see patients at diagnosis, depending on the stage of diagnosis, we do know what, you know, based on statistics, what kind of expectations we have. And in a situation where curative care is not a feasible target, one should introduce palliative care even at that point in time. But some of us look at palliative care just like you look at complementary medicine. It improves the quality of life whilst undergoing the anti-cancer treatment that may be curative. Now, I'm fully aware, I think most of us fully aware, that palliative care should be integrated into the cancer care earlier. But the reality of this is that it may not be because of patients' perception. A lot of patients are not quite ready to talk about palliative care because the equation of palliative care means end-of-life care, which is really not the case.
Okay. We have a question here. 40 votes, actually, for this one. Question, will Malaysia ever consider euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide? Who's going to take this question?
I think Sylvia is in the best position to answer that.
Okay, I will try. I think many people have, again, a misconception that palliative care equals euthanasia. It absolutely doesn't. I think the definition of euthanasia is a physician ending somebody's life who has requested the physician to do so. That's illegal in this country, and from the palliative care perspective, we would want it to remain so. There are a lot of issues around it. I don't know how far you want to go into the discussion. It's argued on the basis of patients' autonomy and patients' right to end their life if they want to. But I think when you look at it, what is autonomy? And do you have autonomy if you don't have good end-of-life care? And I think we should be looking as a society to how do we give people the best possible care, not at how do we help people end their lives. And certainly as a physician, I don't think that's what we should be looking at.
What are you actually looking at? Is it more about pain management at that stage?
Yeah, it is about pain management. It is about keeping patients as comfortable as possible at the end of life. It's also about discussions. It's also about understanding meaning and creating meaning, which can be done through open conversations. It's certainly not about ending life.
Okay.
I think there's also this conception that palliative care is something which has to be done by specialists, people who, you know, only do palliative care. But honestly, palliative care should be done by many doctors, people in the public sector, people in the primary healthcare sector, should have a role in terms of palliative care and the understanding of palliative care. Unfortunately, though, a lot of doctors don't want to talk about death. And so they push it away, and they don't open the conversations with patients. Many patients will not ask their doctor about it because they're scared.
But then, as Martin said, even the doctors are very sensitive that some patients don't want to talk about it.
But as a doctor, you should initiate conversation.
Yeah. I want to just support Henry on that because I think patients are scared, but doctors are also scared. Many doctors haven't been taught much about palliative care. And they should be in all fields. And they are very scared to initiate conversations, or they actually, and that happened just the other day, tell patients, oh, well, you're not ready to give up yet, so I'm not going to refer you to palliative care. So if patients are getting that messages from physicians, then we've got a long way to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Martin.
That's correct. In short, so we do have a long way to go, Sylvia. You got a long, big job ahead of you trying to educate the, you know, ignorant oncologists.
I said primary healthcare, so I didn't.
That's an easy way out of not answering the question.
It's actually not the oncologists so much as all physicians we're talking about. There's very little palliative care education just coming in now into undergraduate, into nursing care, into everything. So there's a whole lot of us older generation doctors who don't know much about it.
Dr. Martin, at what stage do you think a patient should initiate this discussion with you if you're afraid to initiate the discussion?
I'm not afraid to initiate discussion, no, certainly not. But I'm always sensitive to patients. I listen to their non-verbal communication with me before initiating such discussions. I always ask them whether they would want palliative care services to be involved, hospice care to be involved in their care. In the institution where I work, unfortunately, we do not have a palliative care physician, and the palliative care that the patient receives are actually generated by ourselves. So a lot of what we do is also termed palliative care. Pain control, symptom control, so part and parcel of palliative care. Mm. The point of which we refer to hospices when the care at home needs to be initiated as well, when the patient becomes more and more dependent on other people for their care. If they are generally very independent, even initiating the kind of palliative care discussion may be a blow to their morale, actually. Yeah, that's the perception that we might have about patients. That may not be exactly what Sylvia would have. It's true that it's been shown that palliative care done together with anti-cancer treatment does improve quality of life, does extend life as well, and there are enough evidence of that. But that information hasn't quite filtered to the general public yet.
Is it also a perception that the oncologist will only refer to palliative care when you have exhausted all options?
That's also not correct. Of course, I cannot speak for all the oncologists, but as far as our training is concerned, palliative care is part and parcel of cancer care. So we initiate them. It's a question of who initiates them, whether we initiate them at our level or whether we need another level of support from the palliative care physicians or from the hospice, they should be referred accordingly.
Okay. Coming back to pain management, as Sylvia said, is a large part of end-of-life care. There is a lot of research on medical marijuana, either as a treatment or pain management option. Is this going to be explored in Malaysia? I don't think any of you can answer that.
No.
But,
no.
But what are your thoughts on medical marijuana, Sylvia?
I think it's still quite controversial. Personally, I've got no experience of using it, obviously, as I work here. I think inevitably it is something that may be something of the future when there's more evidence around it.
In fact, if you read a lot of the literature, medical marijuana is good for almost everything, you know?
You are not supposed to say that.
Yes.
You didn't hear that.
What I meant is good for... Medically speaking, I mean, oncologically speaking, I've got to qualify myself there. Yeah. So it's good for pain control, it's good for quality of life. In fact, it's also good for control of fits as well. But I think the research is still very much ongoing. I know in America, a lot of states have actually approved medical marijuana, but not quite yet as far as Malaysia is concerned. So,
do you think it will ever come here?
In fact, in the background, it's already here. People are using opium, for example.
Yep.
People don't openly say it, but they've openly asked me about it, whether it's okay to take opium. In a situation where there's end-of-life issues, I really don't see much issues if taking opium sort of calms them down and controls their pain better.
But we use morphine, don't we?
Morphine does have got some problems associated with it, the drowsiness associated with it, the constipation, and so on and so forth. What is your experience, Sylvia?
So, yes, we use morphine, and that is an opioid, but we're using it specifically for symptom control. And if you use it for pain, it doesn't cause addiction. On the ground, if we visit patients at home, yeah, we find some patients are using opium, often for pain, and some patients are still using it recreationally. I think there is a real fear about crossover from of opioids being abused, but we haven't found any problems with that.
Question.
Thank you very much. A central issue in palliative care is about dealing with death as much as dealing with life. In that way, I believe there is a big chunk of contributions by families and how families can play a role in palliative care. When and how family members can play a role in palliative care. And second is about the angle of faith in addressing palliative care. And there is such thing as faith healing. Spiritually, I don't think the professionals can handle that. It has to be professional, spiritual component of the community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Soundry, you want to chime in?
I'll chime in from the earlier stages of cancer, in the sense that at the National Cancer Society, when someone comes to us with a diagnosis of cancer and we talk to them about their cancer, we also talk to them about the support systems which are available. And even at stage one, stage two, at early stages of cancer, we mention hospice. We mention the idea that palliative care is there, hospice is there, not just for end-of-life care, but during the treatment when you need support. And one of the things we do is to say that sort of support you might not need all the time. You might need it for a short period of time, and then you might never have to see them again until later on in the disease if it occurs. So I think opening up the conversation early makes a huge difference in acceptance later on whether or not they want to do hospice care or palliative care. Because I think one of the issues Sylvia, I'm sure, faces is that people come right at the end when there's nothing much that can be done. And that perpetuates this whole idea that palliative care is only there when you're about to die. So we need to open that conversation up very much earlier. And the people that you need to open it up are the family members. Because the family members are the ones who fight tremendously for the patient. That fight might be synergistically with the patient, meaning that they are in communication with their loved one who has that cancer, and they're looking at what that person wants out of their journey, or they're doing it very separately. on a different plane and going along and just doing what they want to do without really engaging their loved one in that conversation. So for any caregiver here, communication is really, really the key in terms of how a person's journey continues with cancer. You have to have those hard talks with the people around you and the people that you love. Sometimes going aggressively at something is not just the way to go. And I as a caregiver myself, for my mother, I know sometimes you just want to sit there and you want to just say, what can I do? And you look for the most active things that you can do that you think will help that patient at the end of the day, that person that you love tremendously at the end of the day. Sometimes that's not the way to go. And where I failed as a caregiver, and I will say it straight out, is that I didn't look at my mother as a person. I looked at her as a patient. I looked at her as someone who has a disease, and I have to fight that disease. I didn't look at her as a person who has needs outside of what that cancer is doing to her. That's where the family member really needs to look at, because the doctor will look at the disease. But you as the family member, you have to look at that person and recognize that that person is an individual, is unique outside of that disease.
The importance of faith. Who wants to tackle that one? Sylvia?
This is a huge part of how people cope with illness is through prayer, through looking to faith. And I absolutely agree, it is not the healthcare professional's area of expertise. But it is our role to acknowledge that that is an important part of every individual and to support how they go through that journey. And if they need help to access professionals, then we need to facilitate that. But often it's families who do that, not us. We're there to acknowledge.
Questions?
Hello, hi. In the surgical malignancies update in 2017, we noted that management of cancer patients tend to be 80% prolonging life, and the final 20% ends up becoming, you know, pain management before death. The ideal would be from the moment of diagnosis that we should already engage with the oncology team as well as palliative. So how do we educate healthcare professionals or healthcare providers that from the moment of diagnosis that they should already counsel these patients that, you know, we should talk to someone? Secondly, how is it that we make them realize that there's a difference between palliation, palliative care, as well as palliative surgery? Thank you.
Thank you. You have got to be in the medical profession. Just the terminology used. Healthcare professionals starting this conversation, I think that's an interesting comment, and I think we would agree that that needs to happen a lot more. Palliative care and versus palliation and surgery. Do you want to shed some light on what's the difference?
Going back to the beginning, I think what we, as clinicians, as oncologists, when somebody is diagnosed with cancer, the approach that we take is that, is this curable, is this not curable? So if it's a curable cancer, which is, you know, generally meaning that cancer is at an early stage, and of course curative treatment should be something that's initiated. But if the diagnosis is at a stage of stage 4, for example, and for all intents and purposes, statistically speaking as well, that cure is not a reasonable target, palliative care in the form of palliative surgery is something that could be done. In this example that was mentioned with regards to cancer of the rectum, having a stoma. Now, there are two aspects to that. It either means that the cancer is not curable anymore because it has metastasized to other parts of the body, or if it's a lower rectal cancer, it's not feasible to do cancer surgery with the aim of curing it with leaving the rectum alone. Yeah, you can have a low rectal cancer which is invading into the anal canal, so you cannot salvage that. So you can do a curative surgery still, but you still end up with a stoma. In that situation.
And a stoma is a bag?
And the stoma is the bag that, you know, the feces comes out at the front of the abdomen. Coming back to the question about palliative care whether we should initiate it right from the beginning. Again, the feeling, prevailing feeling amongst the oncologists, again, is the emphasis of care. If the care is emphasized more in a curative sense, talking about palliative care in that setting may shift your focus to a curative effort at the cancer. And sometimes talking about palliative care in a patient who's got early cancer may be premature. So I don't believe that we should talk about palliative care as a blanket plan of action, that anybody with cancer, that you talk about palliative care right from the beginning. That's why it's important that on follow-up, you are sensitive to the patients and sensitive to the stage of the disease and introduce the subject as we move along.
We spoke earlier about how Malaysians present late, and one of the reasons given, and I'm going to ask you this question only to you, Dr. Martin, as to how we love our alternative therapies and our BOMOs before we actually come and see someone like you.
Yeah.
What's your take on it? Is there space at all for alternative or complementary therapy when it comes to cancer management?
You mentioned alternative, you mentioned complementary. They are two different things. We have to understand that. Alternative therapy refers to treatment of the cancer as a means of treatment, whereas complementary therapy is something that's done by the patient to alleviate sufferings, alleviate side effects from the curative treatment that's being initiated. Now, alternative treatment is a big issue. I'm not saying it's a big problem. I said it's a big issue amongst a lot of people who are diagnosed with cancer. Alternative therapy, unfortunately, there aren't any evidence-based studies to support its use. But for those who do alternative therapy, there are some common commonalities in the feature of alternative therapy. Number one, it guarantees cure. Number two, it guarantees no side effects. So who amongst you, if you are being told that you got a cancer and this treatment guarantees cure, guarantees no side effects, will you take that?
I would.
Of course everybody will take that. Yeah, everybody will take that. But in reality, those of us who are in the field see time and time and time again that people who have done alternative therapy comes in, by the time they come into the allopathic medicine, to the hospital, they are beyond salvage. You know, the disease have gone to a stage 4 situation where the most we can really achieve is some form of control of time and palliation of symptoms. That remains a big problem. So I think there's a disconnect between information, public education, to make people realize that this is indeed a problem. But, you know, this is not a Malaysian problem. It's the whole world problem.
You mean they have BOMOs in the US as well? I didn't realize that.
No, they are called differently
over
there.
The shamans, okay.
Yeah,
that's a nice
word. They're called differently. Differently in different places. And the other unfortunate thing is, of course, they are medically trained people, medically trained doctors who decide to delve into oncology because it's a sexy topic, you know. So they delve into oncology looking at alternative forms of treatment that guarantees cure and guarantees no side effects. And patients will tell you, I went to this doctor, he's a real doctor, and he practices this form of medicine and guarantees cure and guarantees no side effects. And to some extent, that's why people are confused. As far as that is concerned, I think the authorities need to be a bit more proactive in identifying such individuals and take appropriate action.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion from the recent Health and Living Live 2018 event by AIA Vitality. This is an edited recording of the recent Health and Living Live 2018 event by AIA Vitality.
Complementary therapy and alternative therapy in end-of-life care, is there a role in that?
I think it depends very much on why people are looking at the treatments that they're looking at and what they're hoping for. If it is something that is promoting well-being, then there may be a role. Unfortunately, often what alternative medicine is offering is actually a false hope of cure. And it doesn't come without burdens, without side effects, particularly financial burdens, but also side effects. I think it's a very individual choice, and I think people need to be very clear about what they're having, but there isn't much regulation about the claims people make about their treatments. So we do see really very difficult cases where people are taking alternative medicine that can be actually quite damaging with a hope of cure.
And it can be costly as well.
And very costly.
Perception is it's probably going to be cheaper, but do you think it's more costly?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think for some of them it's more costly. But what I just wanted to say is that we're talking about complementary and alternative medicines in Malaysia, but there are some people who actually go overseas for these complementary, or I wouldn't say complementary, but alternative medicines at end of life, when doctors have said, there's not much we can do for you. And that's where the family members come in as well, that, okay, you know, if the medical fraternity here has given up on my loved one, I'm going to take them somewhere else. And I've known of families who have taken their loved ones to South America, to Turkey, to different countries for alternative treatments. One thing I always caution, and whenever I talk to people, is that have you actually talked to that person on what they want at their end of life? Do they want to travel to these countries to seek these alternative treatments, which may or may not work, to be away from the family, to be away from everything that they're comfortable with, for that hope? Whatever treatment that you decide to take, whether it be conventional, alternative, or complementary, etc., do it with communication. Do it from a place where everyone is on the same page and understand what are you hoping to, as what Sylvia said, what are you hoping to achieve by doing this treatment?
Questions from the floor? Yeah.
This is Nirmala. Just now the question was about complementary and alternative medicine. And when we talk about alternative medicine, it's not just BOMO, because we have supplements, we have ion therapy. You can name it. There are so many therapies which are not proven cancer therapies. And when we talk about cost, I have some data to share from the ACTION study. And we had actually done hospital-specific analysis, and it was very interesting to note that the Ministry of Health patients, while they did not suffer financially as bad as patients seeking care in university hospitals or in private hospitals, it was interesting that, you know, when you look at the medical costs, about 17% of them had spent excessively. But when you add this expenditure for complementary and alternative medicine, it pushed another 5% of families into excessive expenditures and even economic hardship. We can't say to people that you cannot take complementary and alternative medicine, but it's about educating them and giving the power to decide. They are willing to pocket out up to 10,000 ringgit in a year, and these are from families who are reporting economic hardship. That means they are not well off to begin with. So it seems that they think it's important. There also needs to be communication between the healthcare practitioners and the patients.
So but they don't believe oncologists like Dr. Martin. They don't buy his story.
But let me get to that, because like the National Cancer Institute, they actually have a traditional and complementary unit, and it's not meant to provide the main treatment. It's to as a complement for people dealing with side effects, acupuncture. So I think it's better for patients when the healthcare professionals are more open and direct the patients right, because sometimes patients are afraid, and the fact that they're willing to spend even though they are suffering means that they think it's important. So that's a point that we need to talk about.
I'd just like to add to that, because I think many patients, it is about the conversation. I think many patients feel abandoned by healthcare professionals, and family members think that we have to do something, we can't just give up. And there's a lot of talk about giving up that isn't actually very helpful, and about a war on cancer and fighting the disease. So that people turn to alternative medicine rather than thinking about how do we live with the reality of what it is.
4 out of 10 Malaysians will need palliative care each year, Sylvia. Mm. Are we able to cope to provide that support?
No. And that's where much more education needs to happen. It's not just to have more palliative care specialists, but to have all healthcare professionals having a higher level of understanding of palliative care. At the basis, it's not complicated. We talked earlier about introducing the conversation about palliative care. When do you do it? How do you do it? It's really very simply about asking patients what their understanding is of their situation and what kind of information they want and what do they want to talk about, and being guided by them. And that's something that I think all healthcare professionals can do. And the more we start to do that, the better access there will be to palliative care, along with some training about pain and symptom management at a simple level.
One last question. Over there. Okay.
I've heard and known of people who get diagnosed with cancer, even though they lead a healthy lifestyle, no alcohol, no tobacco, a clean diet, regular exercise, manageable stress, and yet they get diagnosed with cancer later on in their life. Can somebody get cancer by sheer bad luck? And I forgot to mention that this person that I know of, there's no cancer among his siblings and parents. Follow on to this question, can somebody be overcautious about their lifestyle? Can it backfire later on in their life?
Luck, Dr. Martin. I mean, Dr. Soundarya, I don't know who's going to take this.
I'm not going to take the second part. Because as you can clearly see, I'm not overcautious about my lifestyle. About the first part, it is what we know about cancer in terms of the prevention and the risk factors of cancer. It's honestly like an iceberg. We know what's on top in terms of risk factors, tobacco, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't know what's under the water as yet. And as we go along, we're finding out more and more about cancer. Yes, you know, it can be sheer bad luck. Again, as I mentioned, I'm a caregiver. My mother is someone who doesn't eat red meat. She doesn't smoke. She doesn't drink alcohol. She was a state hockey player, et cetera, so she was fit, et cetera, et cetera. She has 5 different types of cancers. Okay, 89, still alive, doing well. If you want to say sheer bad luck, sheer bad luck. But it's because there's so much about cancer, we really don't know at this point of time.
We're going to wrap up. Sylvia, would you have a message on end-of-life care?
What I hope is that people will start talking more openly and be less afraid of talking about the elephant in the room. That's the symbol that we're using at the moment. It's that sense of it's something there that nobody wants to talk about, and that makes everybody so much more anxious and so much more distressed, and then stops people getting good care as well. So my message is, let's talk about it.
Dr. Martin, one last question for you.
Okay.
And I think I'm going to ask on behalf of my mother, who's sitting over there.
Right.
Does chemotherapy kill you?
Chemotherapy does kill you, in short, so that's why you need to see oncologists, not to see the GP who does it occasionally. No, but seriously, when you talk about chemotherapy, it's a big conversation. And I think the take-home message should not be that chemotherapy kills you. It's important to have conversation to talk about what is that chemotherapy meant to do and what stage is your disease and so on and so forth. The other day we had a public forum and somebody in the audience said, chemotherapy is only helpful in 5% of patients. And his opinion is that chemotherapy should be banned. It's not as simple as that. The chemotherapy is done in the setting at which it is done. Suppose it is done in the adjuvant setting where somebody has got cancer removed, no evidence of cancer, but the stage is relatively advanced. Chemotherapy improves the chance of cure. And the percentage of improvement is very much dependent on the stage of the disease. That's one thing to remember. The second thing is, if chemotherapy is given in a setting where somebody has got a stage 4 cancer, so that's called palliative chemotherapy. And the main aim there is try to control the cancer, to improve quality of life, and also to extend life. But of course, chemotherapy have got side effects, that needs to be managed adequately so that the chemotherapy doesn't kill you.
It doesn't kill you. You said it's yes initially.
It doesn't kill you, no.
Okay, thank you.
No.
Okay. Dr. Sandra, you want to wrap up?
My message, I mean, it echoes what Sylvia said. We need to talk about it at the end of the day. We want to protect our loved ones, yes, definitely. But we're not protecting them by not telling them about their diagnosis. We're not protecting them by not talking to them about what they really want throughout their journey, not just their last days, but throughout the whole journey.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, our panelists, Dr. Sylvia, Dr. Martin, and Dr. Sandra. Thank you.
This event was presented by AIA, helping Malaysians live healthier, longer, better.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.